You are listening to the Cycling Podcast, proudly supported by Lacca. From Milan San Remo to Liège-Bastogne-Liège, the spring monuments are in full flow, and the Cycling Podcast is here for every gripping moment, powered by Lacca. Are you still riding without insurance? Is it worth the risk? Because one crash, one stolen bike, or a wrong turn could see you out of pocket fast. And that's where Lacca comes in, because it's insurance made by cyclists for cyclists. You chip in for the collective's claims each month, so when the claims are low, you pay less in premiums. And when it matters most, Lacca's got your back, with cover that goes further than you think. There's theft and damage at sportives and events, emergency cash if you're left stranded somewhere, legal assistance, and a 50% multi-bike discount. Plus, with zero excess, no depreciation, and optional licensed race and travel cover, you're ready for anything, whether you're riding your local club run or racing across the Alps. Don't wait until it's too late. Thousands of cyclists already ride with the Lacca Collective, and now it's your turn. For a limited time, listeners to the Cycling Podcast in the UK, Netherlands, France, Belgium and Germany get 30 days of free insurance when they sign up with the code TCP30 at lacca.co/TCP. So get covered now. Your future self will thank you for it. Full details are in the episode show notes. Terms and conditions apply.
You are listening to the Cycling Podcast.
Hello and joining you on April 22nd, 2025. After a weekend when, to apply a popular Italian metaphor to the Amstel Gold Race, Tadej Pogacar entered the conclave as the Pope and came out as a Cardinal. My name is Daniel Freiber, and I'm the host of this episode of the Cycling Podcast, in which there'll be no discussion of who will replace the sadly departed Pope Francis as the actual pontiff, and you won't find anyone, I don't think, pronouncing on the end of Tadej Pogacar's reign over pro cycling just yet. Joining me for what will be a shorter, punchier episode than usual today, because we do have two Arrivé episodes this week. It's Lionel Burney.
Hello, Daniel.
And happily sipping his half pint of Amstel Shandy beside him, it's Robert Hatch.
Hello, hello, Robert. Wow, that proper intro.
He's in trouble.
I like that.
He's
a short, trouble. Punchy one replaced by a full name.
Punchy for a punchy race. The cheese roll, the upside down cheese roll, flesh well on, of course. I'm delighted to report we've found someone else who shares my distaste for the first of the Ardennes Classics. Don't know if you can guess who that is, but they, he, she, whoever it is, will feature later in the podcast. Rob, I've got a very small bones pick with you. Very rarely am I disappointed with your commentary, but today I thought you missed an opportunity on the Tour of the Alps, because there was a moment on the stage that started, and did it start and finish in Sterzing?
No, it finished in Sterzing. It started in Mezzo Lombardo.
There you go. Well, it finished in Sterzing Vipiteno. Famous in Italy for what? Yogurt. It's a famous brand of yogurt. And at one stage, on the final loop of the town, we had Marco Fridge on the front. I thought, I was just waiting.
Yes,
I was
shot.
Just waiting for you at that moment.
No, I was eternally frustrated with television directors for the last couple of days. So I think I was desperately trying to spot what was going on, because we didn't seem to always, unfortunately, see it in the centre of our picture. So it was interesting. But yeah, I'll think more about yogurts tomorrow. Yogurts and apples. There you go.
I'm sure we could do a whole podcast on yogurts and cycling, featuring Oscar Freire and other very tenuous links. Chaps, as I said, it's going to be a punchy episode for a punchy week in professional cycling, where the punchers will be very prominent. But we are going to have, as usual, the newsette. Maybe slightly shorter than usual newsette. Shall I kick us off?
Why not?
Last week in the newsette, we omitted to mention the fact that the Movistar team has new investment. Quantum Pacific Management has acquired a 43% stake in Abarca Sports, which of course is Movistar's parent company. 43%, so still a minority. But but a substantial stake nonetheless. Now, who are Quantum Pacific Management? Well, they invest in other sports. They have a 28% stake in Atletico Madrid, the football team. They also have, I think it's an 80% stake in Famalicão in Portugal, which is another football team. And they were founded by a gentleman called Idan Ofer. Now, he's an Israeli billionaire, was a few years ago the richest man in Israel, I am led to believe. Lots of different interests in various different sectors, various different companies, and Quantum Pacific Group is one of them. So, what does this mean for Movistar, the team? Well, I guess it means they'll have more resources in the future. Maybe, Rob, the team will become slightly less Spanish, Hispanic in influence, and the sort of markets they're trying to reach and appeal to. Would you agree?
I would agree. And that was already happening to a degree, wasn't it, with Movistar and, of course, Telefónica owning different companies like O2, for example, in United Kingdom. I think they were already sort of becoming a bit more international. The fact that this particular conglomerate has a big interest in Atletico Madrid, I suppose they know the Spanish market, they know the Spanish sports scene. And I'm led to believe that the CEO of the company that is going to appear on the jersey, something shipping, is it, I think? A big company based in Singapore.
Eastern Pacific Shipping.
Yes, I'm led to believe that that's the CEO of that particular company is a massive cycling fan as well.
Of course, Telefónica, which is the pair, would it be accurate to say they're the parent company of Movistar?
Of Movistar. Movistar is one of their brands, basically.
Yes. They, of course, announced recently that they were extending their main sponsorship of the team until 2029. I should also just march myself off to Corrections Corner, because the name of the team in which, as I said, Idan Ofer already has investments is Famalicão.
I'd like to go next, if that's all right. Antonio Tiberi. It's a quick bit of news. Not great news for Tiberi fans, for Italian cycling, but surely you'd think that the initial panic is over, because during stage two of the Tour of the Alps, we saw a crash in a tunnel, didn't we? And Salvatore Puccio was one of the riders who had to abandon because of that crash. We then saw a graphic flash up to say that Antonio Tiberi, who's aiming for the Giro podium this year as a young Italian GC contender for Bahrain victorious, they said he'd abandoned as well, and we assumed it was because of the crash that we didn't see particularly well. But then news came to light that he's been suffering with gastrointestinal issues, and that was the reason for him stepping off. So you should imagine that despite an initial panic for Italian fans there, Antonio Tiberi would recover and should be on the start line in Albania. So Tiberi out, but not yet out of the Giro d'Italia.
Well, it falls to me, chaps, to talk about Barry Hoban, who sadly passed away at the weekend, age 85. A bona fide legend of British cycling, really, I mean, without any doubt. I mean, he was part of the first intake of the British Cycling Hall of Fame back in 2010. And until the likes of Mark Cavendish and Geraint Thomas came along, he really was the kind of record holder of British cycling achievement in certainly the Tour de France, because he won 8 Tour de France stages, which was a record for a British rider until Mark Cavendish equaled and then overtook, well, not just Barry Hoban, but Mark Cavendish overtook everybody, including Eddie Merckx, of course. Hoban also won Gent-Wevelgem in 1974. He beat Eddie Merckx and Roger de Vlaeminck into second and third that day. And those 8 Tour de France stages, well, the first one was tinged with tragedy, of course, because it came the day after his friend and rival rider, really, because they had a really keen rivalry as amateur riders, Tom Simpson, died on Mont Ventoux in the 1967 Tour de France. And Hoban won the stage the following day. He was allowed to ride clear of the peloton and win the stage as a mark of tribute from the whole peloton to Tom Simpson. William Fotheringham, our very good friend and colleague from the press room, who wrote an excellent biography of Tom Simpson's life called Put Me Back on My Bike, he kind of came to the conclusion that perhaps Hoban winning that stage that day was not the choice of all of the riders in the Great Britain team. But nevertheless, it was a fitting one, because Hoban and Simpson were, as I say, they were friends. They crossed swords as amateur riders. Hoban won another stage in much happier circumstances the following year. In fact, it was a mountain stage that he won in Sallanches in the Alps. He became the first British rider to win two stages in a single tour. He won back-to-back stages in 1969. And until Geraint Thomas broke his record last summer, Hoban had finished more editions of the Tour de France than any other British rider. Also won a couple of stages of the Vuelta and that Gent-Wevelgem, as I mentioned. And really, you know, along with Tom Simpson, was the kind of the rider of the generation. Certainly cycling fans of my dad's age and era, Barry Hoban was pretty much the only person flying the flag for British cycling at the Tour de France in the 1970s. There were many years when he was the only British rider in the race. And a lot of his achievements stand up there, having only recently been equaled, or in the case of his third place in Liège-Bastogne-Liège, bettered very recently by Tom Pidcock. And was third in Paris-Roubaix as well in 1972. That was equaled by Roger Hammond in 2004. So a real kind of icon of British cycling. And as I say, he kind of carried the torch for British cycling at a time when the sport wasn't very popular here. It was really a kind of curious foreign sport. So Barry Hoban, a very, very fine career and a legacy that lasts to this day.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour, to remind me to tell you that this episode is also sponsored by NordVPN, the fastest virtual private network in the world. Now, I signed up years ago now when I realised that some of the internet connections I was using when I was travelling, working away for the cycling podcast might not have been all that secure. I was connecting in hotels, sometimes using internet hotspots in public places, using the Wi-Fi in the press room, or sometimes connecting up using my mobile phone connection. And I wanted to be safe and secure in the knowledge that all of my private data was staying private. And NordVPN gives me that peace of mind. So I know that information such as my bank details, passwords, and online identity are being protected when I'm online. And because NordVPN's account can be used on up to 10 devices, I have it protecting my phone, my laptop, even our Wi-Fi router at home. It will also protect you from viruses, malicious malware, and phishing websites. So safety and security when online is the primary reason for a NordVPN subscription, but there are others too. Say you're away on holiday or traveling for work and you want to carry on watching your favorite TV shows or streaming services or sporting events that might not be available in the country you're in, well, you can switch your region very easily, select a virtual location in a country that is showing the event and carry on watching. If you want to start with NordVPN today, you can do so with a great deal. 4 extra months free on top of a 2-year plan. Go to nordvpn.com/TCP. It's no risk either, because NordVPN's 30-day money-back guarantee will mean that if you try it out and it's not for you, very unlikely, I know, you can get your money back. That's nordvpn.com/TCP.
Well, chaps, we're going to talk about the beginning, shall we say, of the Limburg / Ardennes Classics in just a moment. One thing we missed in the newsette, we just mentioned the Tour of the Alps, which you've been commentating on, Rob, until today. Giulio Ciccone, until today. Giulio Ciccone was in the very fetching sort of lime green leader's jersey, which reminds me of the old Tour de Romandie leader's jersey, long, long time ago. But yesterday's stage win caused a bit of controversy, caused a bit of beef, because in trademark Ciccone fashion, he cast away his sunglasses as a sort of celebration as he came over the line, threw them into the crowd. And they were picked up by a young fan. He was subsequently fined by the UCI 250 euros or Swiss francs still?
Swiss francs nowadays, still.
And I did have, but I don't currently have the communique in front of me, the exact wording was carelessly disposing. You've got it.
Disposing of other objects, bracket sunglasses, in a careless manner in the finish. I mean, they didn't even get their language right, for goodness sake, if they're going to be so strict on something like that. I mean, I was thinking whether to mention this or not in the broadcast today. Adam was desperate to mention it. He sent me the screen grab overnight, and I thought, you know what? I don't often like giving personal opinion. My job as a commentator is to be sort of the arbiter. But I just thought, what on earth are they playing? Have a word with yourselves.
You've got to have rules, son.
But what's the rule there for?
You can't have people throwing, you know, you have to extrapolate and think, what if someone disposed of something else?
Well, let's think about Tom Steele's in the Tour de France in 97, I think it was, when he threw a bidon in anger in the finishing sprint.
But there's intent, isn't there? And that's it. It's quite clearly a Ciccone trademark celebration. Yes, you have to have rules, but where's the nuance? Where's the understanding?
You do.
And where's the human being, yes, in the middle making the decision, guys?
If they'd landed in a recycling bin for the appropriate type of plastic, I would have agreed with you, but...
In Sud Tirol, that would have gone down very well if it had landed in the... As long as it was the right recycling bin.
Killjoys.
Do you know what, Rob? And I fully understand why Adam, in your broadcast today, brought this up. But it grinds my gear slightly when people bring up the sock length.
Oh, yeah.
And they beat the UCI with that stick. Because, anyone who talks about, or any team who is going into wind tunnels and bragging about, boasting about the gains they're getting from clothing, and you know, we know that teams wear aero socks nowadays, they then really have no right to lament the UCI establishing a baseline or establishing a limit for that kind of thing.
The sock length has become, I completely agree on that point, it's become a really silly thing to beat the UCI with, and I hope you won't find me talking about that myself too much. But in this case, all this discussion that's going on in the background at the minute about making cycling more interesting, making it more entertaining. The guy's an entertainer. Yeah, it's not something I would do. I wouldn't want to throw nice glasses away, but it's his thing. It's not doing anyone any harm. It made a young fan's day. We're all talking about it. It was a bit of exuberance, a bit of celebration, rather than someone just being boring. I do not understand. I really don't understand why they had to fine him for it.
To get into the weeds of this, who are his sunglasses sponsor?
No idea.
Sponsors? Do you know? Because I'm not suggesting there's anything disingenuous from the team. I saw Luca Guercilena, the team manager, he posted about this on Instagram. But in the past, we have seen teams caught and invite bans and sanctions for promotional purposes in a quite smart, humorous way. For example, the Saeco team made a real virtue of this it started in 1996, I think, when Cipollini wore red shorts with his Italian national team jersey. I think that was the first fine he got. And then, as I say, they made a big virtue of this over a few years, and he would constantly defy and sort of complain about it as well, complain about the fact they were getting fines. But obviously it was great publicity for Saeco, the sponsors. Then we got him sort of turning up to tour stages in a toga and a chariot, which was great fun as well. Then wind forward even further, and same team, Saeco, they had this campaign, Legalise My Cannondale, where they were sort of railing against the UCI weight limits on bikes and drawing people's attention to this. And in one Giro d'Italia in 2004, they wore a sort of a stripy kit, black and white horizontal stripes, with Legalise My Cannondale on the front to, again, suggest that the UCI should scrap its weight limit on bikes. All great publicity. This is great publicity for whoever makes Giulio Ciccone's sunglasses.
So such great publicity.
Own goal in that respect.
Such great publicity that none of us know which brand of sunglasses they were. If he'd worn them on his face a bit longer, I might have had a chance. Mario Cipollini, of course, you know, he changed the rules of cycling, didn't he? Because for years he got fined for wearing matching yellow shorts with his yellow jersey in the Tour de France and so on. Now that's absolutely, it's basically the done thing, isn't it? Just on this, before we move on, remember a few weeks ago, Isaac Del Toro won Milano Torino and his jersey was unzipped as he crossed the line and celebrated, and he got a fine for not zipping up his jersey, which is another UCI regulation. I suppose to protect the sponsors' interests, he claimed afterwards that his zip had broken.
It had. I remember commentating on the race. It was broken at the bottom.
Ah,
He'd got that thing where it was zipped halfway up and fucking like a cape.
You know the sort of speed suits they were. Yeah, the strange zips.
But, you know, without wanting to go all po-faced and overly serious, 10 days ago, a spectator threw a bidon at Matthew van der Poel in Paris-Roubaix. And, of course, we were all, you know, quite rightly, you know, that is just totally unacceptable. We didn't mention last week, actually, that the fan, if I can use that word in question, did turn himself into the police. He owned up and was very apologetic and is waiting to see what the consequences of throwing that bidon will be. I'm not for a second saying that Giulio Ciccone throwing away his sunglasses is in the same category, but I'm with Daniel. Rules are rules, Rob. And if we can't respect the rules, what have we got? Come on, let's move on. I can't believe we spent however many minutes talking about sunglasses being thrown away in a carefree fashion when the Olympic champion, double Olympic champion, Remco Evenepoel, has reignited the world of cycling over the weekend.
He certainly has. I mean, he's got his own bling going on with the whole gold and everything, isn't there? There's a lot of talk about that. But one final point, Lionel. I have to have the last word on this. I'm so sorry. But we're all mourning about, quite rightly, AI is going to do this. The computers are taking over the world. We've got a human brain and heart in the middle here to see that it's different. It's not a spectator throwing somebody in an aggressive manner at somebody. It's a celebration, for goodness sake. Anyway, yeah.
Rob Hatch would like the UCI regulations to be one page long and to say it's one of them ones.
Well, no, I just like human beings with hearts and brains to interpret them, for God's sake. Anyway, yes, let's move on.
Okay, now let's talk about Remco Evenepoel and Matthias Schelmose and not drinking their pints of Amstel. No, let's not. Well, what we need in this discussion
them.
Is...
I'm with them as well on that particular drop.
What we need here is some perspective. Who better to provide some perspective than a man who has seen it all in professional cycling, particularly the classics, Hugo Corvitz. It's time for this week's Corvitz Corner.
Pay attention, freebie. I think cycling was reborn a bit on Easter. For the first time in years, the race had not been run once Pogačar had accelerated. Thanks to Remco Dickit, it was no coincidence that Evenepoel called to put Pogačar to order, even though he had Schelmose on his luggage rack. Remco was angry because UAE Team Emirates had continued to race hard, even though he had crashed together with other riders. In Bergen ter Bleid, at the end of an exciting Amstel Gold race, we had two winners and one loser. Matthias Janssen Schelmose got the big pot of beer as the winner. Remco Evenepoel was the mental winner and Tadej Pogačar the big loser. Remco Evenepoel is a constrictor, a cyclist who squeezes his prey little by little. I'm curious about La Doyenne, the oldest and last monument of the spring. More than about the Flèche Wallonne, which is only a 3-minute race that I don't like. On Wednesday, you have to climb the Muur of Huy, and the race is over. The Amstel Gold race could have been a marker about the exact value ratios between Pogačar and Evenepoel. How reborn cycling really is, we will find out on Sunday on the Boulevard de la Souvenire in Liège. That's a street full of tradition, where Eddy Merckx set a new record with a fifth victory 50 years ago. In terms of ambition, Evenepoel has nothing to learn from Pogačar, who has been racing at the top level since the Strade Bianche. Evenepoel, on the other hand, first had to recover from his big crash against the door of a postal car. The double Olympic champion is as fresh as a daisy. What does the proverb say? The postman always rings twice. Liège-Bastogne-Liège could be the finale of an exciting spring with the great duel. Will it be Evenepoel's third victory in La Doyenne? Or will Pogačar take his third Liège-Bastogne-Liège? We will know the answer on Sunday afternoon.
Well, chaps, Hugo, as the weeks go by, delivers more and more of these zingers.
The postman always rings twice. Kurovitz delivers.
Remco, the constrictor, the best of all, Flèche Wallonne, only a three-minute race that I don't like. Scale Moser was on the luggage rack, and so on and so on.
Podrakar, we're going to have a word with Hugo about his pronunciation of Podrakar. Are we going to let that go?
I think we're going to excuse that. First stop, chaps, in our roundup of the hilly races that occurred last week. Brabantse Pijl, comeback for Remco Evenepoel, and what a comeback it was. Away with Wout van Aert in the finale, and then dispatched van Aert. We had last week in Corvett's Corner Hugo eavesdropping on the van Aert family meeting after which race was it? It was Flanders. Was it Flanders? No, Roubaix. It was Roubaix, where van Aert's son, Georges, was heard to ask his father, how come you're always finishing fourth? Well, Wout obviously took that to heart, because fast forward a few days and he finished second. So an improvement of two places. Unfortunately, Remco Evenepoel cleaned him up.
Second sprint this year coming in, we'd have expected van Aert to really clean up himself and win. Think back to Dwars de Vlaanderen and Nielsen Paulus. I think, like most people, expecting van Aert just to win that. But credit to Remco. What a comeback, eh? Pogacar said he wasn't expecting anything different, was he? But he was mightily impressive. And they were both away for 50 kilometres, let's not forget, in that race, since the Moskestraat as well.
And let's put it in perspective, because they did have, the pair of them did have a passenger, a bit unfair to call Joe Blackmore a passenger, but he was riding in that group, and then until the moment that he couldn't follow the wheels. And I think that puts in perspective just how strong Remco Evenepoel and Wout van Aert were. I mean, Evenepoel looked amazing, didn't he? Not just the gold bike, the gold helmet, the gold glasses to mark the double Olympic gold medals that he won last year, road race and time trial, of course. But he just looked, he looked like he's been part of this stellar spring. And yet this was his first race since Il Lombardia last October. And after the kind of Pogacar-Van der Poel duel that we've had over the first part of the spring, I felt last week that cycling is in need of a couple of new storylines just to reinvigorate everything. And we really got it over the weekend, I thought. And it whets the appetite for the next two races to come, because it did feel like Pogacar was just going to do a clean sweep. And now I think we know we've got some races on our hand. And certainly Friday's race was, in common with the Tour of Flanders and Paris-Roubaix and some of the others, it was an actual race again. You know, they were racing against one another, two very equally matched riders coming to the line together. And it was one of those ones where I didn't actually know whether to expect van Aert to beat Evenepoel in that sprint. I wasn't certain. So it wasn't really a surprise, especially when just you look at Evenepoel, just how good he looks on a bike. I mean, he always does, but it was a great performance. And then, well, he followed it up on Sunday at Amstel Gold, but, well, came up short. I mean, another extraordinary race, 50 fantastic kilometres of racing at Amstel Gold.
I mean, it's funny, isn't it? He didn't win that race, did he? But I thought he was man of the match, because Scalmose was brilliant, wasn't he, in winning it and the way he played it. And it was a lovely to see him shocking even himself when he came across the line and winning there. But with that Evenepoel darting out and really pulling that chase along, then even though he was tiring, Pogacar might still have stayed away.
What was, if we do move straight ahead to Amstel Gold, chaps, and it was obviously a different configuration, different sort of paradigm. We saw Pogacar attack and get reeled in. Not the absolute first time that it had happened, but there haven't been many occasions in big one-day races. It happened in Imola in 2021, if you recall. There were one or two other occasions that I've heard mentioned over the last couple of days. But it was different from what we have become accustomed to seeing over the last few weeks, certainly, and a couple of years. What made the difference? I would suggest that the presence of Elan van Wilder made a huge difference. The presence of a leader like Evenepoel, who, as we know, is a very charismatic leader, and that is a team, although they were maligned, we maligned them slightly in the Cobbled Classics, a team that haven't been doing well in those races in the last couple of years. They're a team with a clear and charismatic leader, and when he's present at races, I think they have a very linear strategy and way of thinking. There's no ambiguity about what they're going to do. And Remco is never someone really who sort of looks around and waits for other people to take responsibility. He always goes into a race to win. So that was a big difference. But what else dictated that Group 2, the dreaded Group 2 syndrome didn't descend and we got the race we did?
Well, I think because Matthias Gelmoser of Lidl Trek, he put it all on the line, didn't he? He risked something, and it was really only Remco Evenepoel who was prepared to kind of match that risk. They took a risk by trying to ride across to Pogacar, knowing that all of the evidence of the spring is that Tadej Pogacar can ride solo for 40-odd kilometres and win races, and he's very, very difficult to catch. They could have just sat tight, and if they'd sat tight for the margin probably would have been pretty slim, maybe another 5, 6, 7 kilometres. The gap might have gone out a bit more if there'd been a bit more playing around. But they refused to lie down. Two key riders refused to lie down. And Remco Evenepoel may not feel he was rewarded for it, but Matthias Gelmoser certainly was.
I think I heard a quote from Wout van Aert afterwards actually saying that he had decided that he thought that Pogacar had too big of a gap, and that for that reason he didn't make the jump across when Evenepoel and Gelmoser did. I think himself he was sort of not quite regretting, because I don't think he really races with too many regrets, does he, Wout van Aert? He just gives what he gives and the result is what it is. And I think he was saying, maybe, yeah, I could have gone across for that. And, you know, he felt good and he ended up with another fourth place in the end. But it's funny, I had a message on Instagram off one of Skelmoser's old minders and coaches when he was up in the Basque Country. And it was the night before the race. And they said, well, you watch out for Matthias tomorrow. You watch out for Matthias. I was like, yeah, well, do you know what? Yeah, he's a good rider, isn't he? And we'll see if he's up there, not thinking that he was going to do what he was going to do. Obviously, they knew he was on fantastic form. And my, did he show it, didn't he? Because I certainly wasn't picking out Skelmoser out of those three at the end to win that sprint either.
You know, it was interesting casting our minds back to exactly a year ago and those now infamous pictures of him at Flèche Wallonne convulsing in the sort of Arctic temperatures of Flèche Wallonne last year. And yeah, fast forward a year. And of course, the last time really we'd seen him this year, he was lying on the tarmac at Paris-Nice, having crashed in the penultimate stage, wasn't it? Again, in terrible, terrible weather. One other thing that occurred to me about Amstel Gold is that in that particular phase of the race where Pogacar went away, the visibility is very good. Very clear sight line. You can see exactly what's going on a few hundred metres ahead of you. It's kind of the opposite of the Tour of the Alps. You can see exactly what's going on. And I don't know whether that aided the sort, or that sort of helped the chase group just to know exactly where Pogacar was.
Certainly helps a television broadcast, doesn't it? We've seen that a few times in the last few years. Yeah, I suppose it could have done.
The fact that Pogacar kept looking back as well might be significant. You know, he perhaps didn't feel all that comfortable or didn't feel like the gap was quite big enough. And perhaps because when he looked over his shoulder, he could have a clear sight of what was going on behind at times. Maybe that was a factor. You know, we don't often see too many moments of sort of self-doubt in Tadej Pogacar, do we? I mean, certainly not this spring. But there was a kind of a moment where he looked like he knew he was going to be caught, and he was kind of calculating how he would win it from there with two riders for company. I mean, if we wind it back a bit to the moment where he went away, it was actually Julian Alaphilippe who made the first significant move, wasn't it? 47.5 kilometres to go. Pogacar reacted very quickly, and I thought we had this kind of like, you know, when you cut down a tree and you can tell the age of the tree from the rings. It was a bit like the sort of, you know, felling the tree of the last decade of professional cycling and seeing where Julian Alaphilippe now stands in relation to Tadej Pogacar. I mean, they're just not planets in the same orbit as one another anymore, are they? Because 5 kilometres later, it was on the Kreuzberg, wasn't it, that Pogacar went solo. Alaphilippe just couldn't follow anymore. And I think at that point, I thought, well, done and dusted. Like I say, it was that sort of defiance from Skelmoser first, and then Remco Evenepoel going across to him, and the combination of those two riders. And I think significantly, Matthias Skelmoser won, but he did say afterwards that he was basically telling Remco Evenepoel that he needed Remco to ride hard on the climbs. He couldn't contribute on the climbs. And so already probably the sort of the physical and mental games were going on from that point. And Skelmoser played it absolutely fantastically, didn't he? Because you know, of the three of them, he was the least fancied. He could sit tight in the wheels and let the world champion and the Olympic champion race together. And so they were always slightly vulnerable to Skelmoser, I felt.
A couple of other things, chaps, before we look ahead to Flèche Wallonne and Liège-Bastogne-Liège. A couple of pundits I heard suggested that Pogacar had not really paid Skelmoser any attention in the sprint, and that was his undoing. That he even sort of sat down once he thought that he was, I don't know whether that was because his legs had kind of given way when he felt as though he'd passed Remco. That's, I think, a possibility. Secondly, Amstel Gold is a strange race. We've talked many times about how unique it is, how it's unlike really any of the one-day race in professional cycling because of the number, the volume of climbs. Pogacar losing did remind me a little bit, dare I say his name, of the controversial Lance Armstrong losing in Amstel Gold twice and being beaten in sprints by Eric Decker and Michael Bogart. And it became a bit of a bête noire, Amstel Gold, for the controversial Lance Armstrong race. He always wanted to win, but didn't manage to. And the third thing, chaps, I can't remember what it was.
Excellent.
But it was good.
Our very Amstel Gold. It always throws up surprises, even on the podcast.
It will come to me in a second. Oh, the third thing is Pogacar washed? Is he finished?
Oh, yeah.
Was he?
That's it. He's done now. Done.
Yeah, the end
of Vauxhall Conference next year.
But I think there is a real possibility that he was beaten up and battered by Paris-Roubaix. I mean, Larry talked about it on the podcast, didn't he, Lionel, last week when we had him on. That's just the workout, the effort of Paris-Nice. Mm. I'm sorry, not Paris-Nice, Paris-Roubaix was likely to take its toll. And I think some people felt that it wasn't vintage Pogacar on Sunday.
Well, I did say he looked tired in the press conference after Paris-Roubaix. And I mean, that's a ridiculous thing to say. And I think I even said that when I mentioned this in our episode of Arrivé. But he just looked like the light had dimmed a little bit in his eyes after that race, as if everything had been building up to Paris-Roubaix, the anticipation of it, trying to win it, the first race, all of the everything that kind of went with that. And now it's quite a big reset to go from that to the Amstel Flesh Liège triple. It must take quite a lot of mental resources. Larry talked about how instead of sort of holding up in a hotel or a couple of hotels in Belgium for the best part of a month, he's taken himself back home to Monte Carlo and given himself the mental break. Larry said that sounded like a smart strategy, but it's still a long old campaign for Pogacar. He's been going at it since Strade Bianche. So, you know, I felt like he had Remco Evenepoel where he wanted him in the sprint. Remco opened it up, but Pogacar did go, you know, from, it was a long old sprint, wasn't it? Which is probably what Remco was factoring on. And maybe they thought, both of them thought, Skelmoser's been out on his own a little bit longer. Not as, you know, on paper, not as good as Pogacar and Evenepoel. His sprint, you know, clearly no slouch, but you would have thought the other two would be quicker at the pointy end of a long race like that. But no, Skelmoser rode the final sort of 5 or 10 kilometres absolutely perfectly. It didn't get suckered in. You know, he could have made some really key mistakes there. He could have gone to the front and done a bit. He could have tried something earlier. He could have made some big mistakes, and we'd be talking about how he'd blown a great opportunity. But he sat there, let the other two worry about each other, and profited brilliantly. It was a great race, though, wasn't it? And you say Amstel Gold's quite a hard one to, you know, it doesn't fit a sort of cookie cutter. It's not the same every year. It sort of plays out differently according to lots of different factors. Often crashes and the way that the groups breaks down to quite a small number, as it did on Sunday. But in other years, it all stays together and it's a really big group and it gives the race a completely different dynamic, which is probably why there's such a variety of different riders have won it over the years. I mean, you look at the classics and the list of winners kind of bestows greatness upon them. And then, you, no disrespect to Enrico Gasparotto or Roman Kreuziger or what have you, but there's a few sort of wild card years with Amstel Gold. So it's not a formulaic race in the same way that Liège-Bastogne-Liège is, because it's so much harder.
Hey, Mama, you don't have time to be messing around endlessly scrolling to find a caregiver for your child. Let me clue you in to my trick to save time and my sanity when finding a sitter. SitterCity.com. SitterCity knows what they're doing. They've been helping busy parents find the perfect sitter for over 20 years. While other sites overwhelm you by throwing hundreds of random profiles your way, SitterCity matches you with caregivers who actually fit your needs. No endless scrolling, no guesswork. I love that all caregivers undergo ID verification. They have background checks, specialized qualifications, and real parent reviews to know if they showed up on time or really know how to handle my sassy toddler. And if I need help, I can talk to a real live human, not a robot, with SitterCity's delightful team. You know, my employer pays for me to get SitterCity completely free as part of my benefits. Yours could too. SitterCity is my go-to for a smarter, simpler way to find reliable, trustworthy care. Don't wait. Go to SitterCity.com/XX and get the help you need.
When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling, and for the shoppers buying, simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret, with Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going... So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Businesses that sell more sell on Shopify. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/audioboom, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/audioboom to upgrade your selling today. shopify.com/audioboom.
As you said, Daniel, we have a pair of episodes of Arrivé tomorrow, Wednesday, the men's and women's edition of Flesh Well Owned. I keep saying every year, Daniel, we should make the episode as long as it takes the riders to climb the Mur de Huy. So sort of, what is
I'd
it?
I'd be in favour of that.
2 minutes 70, 2 minutes 50 seconds or whatever it is. No, it's a bit longer than that, isn't it? But we will recap all of the tactical nuance of Flesh Well Owned after the race on Wednesday. That will be on the Cycling Podcast feed, wherever you listen to your podcast. There's a bonus episode of Kilometre Zero, which dropped a little bit earlier today. It's called The Beast in the East. And, well, it's shining a light on a great British race, the only British one-day race that's got a UCI ranking. It's the Cycle Classic in the East Midlands, and it's kind of Britain's answer to the Spring Classics, and it's celebrating its 20th anniversary this year. It features farm tracks and the Sommerberg, and well, I talked to three riders who have taken part in it over the years: Matt Stevens, Connor Dunn, and James McCallum, as well as the creator and originator of the race, Colin Clues. So you can listen to that now. We've made it available for everybody on the free feed. Do sign up as a friend of the podcast, though, because that support helps us. We're off to the Giro soon. We've got to cover Brian's wine budget somehow, haven't we? We've got to get ourselves to Albania, Daniel. We need to book some flights for that, don't we? Sign up as a friend of the podcast and support the podcast at thecyclingpodcast.com. And very lastly, the 1101 Cappuccino will be out before the weekend, and it will feature one of my classic tales, something I wrote many years ago about the 1987 edition of Liège-Bastogne-Liège, when a rider in the rainbow jersey won the race. Will we see that happen on Sunday? We shall have to wait and see.
2 minutes 40 or 2 minutes 41 seconds, I believe, the record of the Mur de Huy held by Alejandro Valverde.
Excellent.
So that's our target for tomorrow's episode. I'm just reading about a gentleman local to the Mur de Huy, Michel Thomé, last year in April, climbed the Mur de Huy 66 times in 36 hours, up, down.
Why did
down.
He do that to himself?
That's a lot of cheese rolling.
Would that have been an Everesting attempt? Would that have added up to enough? Probably not, is it? No. No,
I don't think so. Fag packing maths.
My record time is 2 minutes 70 seconds
in a car.
Anyway,
well, chaps, it is everyone's favorite or least favorite race of the year, tomorrow, Flesh Well On. As you said, Lionel, we'll be podcasting on the whistle, whether it is the usual sort of bunch print of the Mur de Huy or something more interesting. And the fact that Tadej Pogacar is in the race, and also the fact that Remco Evenepoel is in the race, that does sort of throw up the tantalizing prospect of something a little bit different, doesn't it? Because, as we know, those are two riders who have tended to strike out pretty early in races. However, every attempt to do that in Flesh Well On over the last 20 years has failed. So, what do you think about tomorrow? I think, first question I wanted to ask you chaps is that, well, I wanted to put it to you that Tadej Pogacar this year, as of this year, I feel he's entered a new phase in his career, and the mystique around Tadej Pogacar has entered a new phase in that any defeat is now going to be interpreted as maybe, possibly, the first clue of a hint, of an inkling of a crisis, if not a demise. Two defeats in big one-day races in a row might give rise to that kind of talk by chumps like us and other podcasters. What do you think?
Pogs become Real Madrid all of a sudden. You can't have two losses and, you know, the manager's out, sort of thing. It is strange. It's funny because it's something I don't like when we all do it, but we all do it because it's sort of journalistically right, because you see him going out there and he's so much better than everyone, and you sort of have to ask the question, as uncomfortable as it is, thinking about it and reading it. And I don't think he's entered a crisis at all. I think, like you say, he's tired from Roubaix. It's a unique effort, the first time he's done it. And, again, he's human, isn't he? I think we've seen that on a few occasions.
He's a good loser as well, yes. Chaps. I don't know if you have sort of picked up on that, or, you know, you can never be totally confident of what someone's reaction is behind the scenes, how angry or frustrated someone is behind the scenes. We're judging very much on what we see, those sort of snapshots behind the podium, his interactions with other riders. But he doesn't seem to me to be someone who really stews when things don't go his way. We've seen it maybe once after the Tour of Flanders when he was beaten by Mathieu van der Poel a few years ago.
I mean, context is everything here, isn't it? His worst result this season is third. I mean, all right, take out the stages, the flatter stages in the UAE Tour, but third at Milan-San Remo is his worst result. I mean, we're talking about such a sort of, the 1% of the 1%, aren't we? So it kind of is human nature, isn't it? When he was beaten on Sunday in the Amstel Gold Race, that's kind of, oh, that's blown the Amstel Flesh Liège Triple Crown. He can't do that this year. I still expect him to be on the podium in both races. Whether he's on the top step remains to be seen. But there is still a very small handful of people who can beat him on the Mur de Huy, and that is probably Remco Evenepoel. I'm going to say Tom Pidcock. And there might be one or two others. I think it will be up to other riders to try and unsettle and unseat the likes of Pogacar and Evenepoel first, because if they go into the bottom of the climb with those two well placed, they're on a sort of hiding to nothing, really. So I don't think it's really up to Pogacar to do anything different, suddenly rip up the kind of the way he would approach this race. He's going to use his climbing ability and his sprint on a steep climb to maximum advantage, and I wouldn't be surprised if in 24 hours time we're talking about Pog's back. He's back. His demise was short-lived. We wrote him off too soon. I mean, we're not writing him off, are we? He's a phenomenal bike rider, but he's in the sort of the tail end of a long campaign now, so it's more about his kind of endurance, mental and physical, than it is about his overall kind of physical ability. Remco Evenepoel has been injured, but on the flip side, he's fresh and mentally fresh, you know, absolutely racing until his eyeballs were kind of bulging out of his head on Friday and Sunday, you know, really hungry to win some races. And that's the little sort of 1 or 2% that Pogacar may not still have. We'll have to see. I don't mean overall. I just mean, you know, in the moment.
Rob, you may have a clear memory, and I must confess a deep dive into one of the appropriate websites would solve this for me, but I don't have many clear memories of Remco Evenepoel winning on the top of these sort of wall type finishes. I remember the first stage that comes to mind when I think of Remco Evenepoel on that kind of finish, stage four I think of the Vuelta a España in 2022 that he won. And it was the first stage back in Spain, finished at La Guardia, won by Primoz Roglic, and Remco Evenepoel struggled, I would say, relative to his level in the rest of the race. He was eighth, and he never really looked like winning on that finish. And I don't have too many memories of other times when he has won on that kind of finish. And that day was a very similar type finish to the Mudahoy.
If you're asking me about Evenepoel, I would say Sunday is much more his day.
Mm.
Skien Moser, I would say tomorrow, we're speaking on Tuesday, is much more, and I would have said this actually before the Sunday flat sprint that he just won. I would have put Skien Moser as much more of a Flèche Wallonne kind of guy than a Liège-Bastogne-Liège kind of guy, but I guess we have to readjust that since we saw what we saw in the sprint. So I think Skien Moser with the form is a name we must mention as well. Evenepoel, I'd think he'd be more likely to win Liège rather than Ennui, but again, that's the great thing about racing at the minute, isn't it? You know, it's possible we're going into a week where Pogacar might not win a race, or then again, he might win two. I mean, everything is possible at the minute, and I'll repeat what I keep saying, we're so lucky to be in such an exciting era.
I know it's not finished, but he didn't look too bad on La Redoute last year in Liège-Bastogne-Liège, did he?
Just a bit. Know.
Skelmers' record in Flèche Wallonne, 18th in 2022, second behind Pogacar in 2023, and that DNF when, as I mentioned earlier, he, like a lot of other riders, was reduced to a sort of shivering wreck in those awful temperatures. So he does have form, that second place in 2023, but we shall see, chaps. Maybe this cheese roll will surprise and delight us tomorrow afternoon. We'll be back then. In the meantime, thank you, Rob.
Thank you.
And thank you, Lionel.
Thank you, Daniel.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burney.